Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. March is Social Work Month. We'll talk about what social work entails, some common misconceptions, and challenges to retaining staff.
Today's discussion includes you, so we invite you to call in. Our in-studio guests are Sonia Begalke-Bannon, Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers, Hawaii; Dana Kano, Child Welfare Services, Department of Human Services; and Dr. Francie Julian Chin, Assistant Professor at the Myron B. Thompson School of Social Work at UH Manoa.
We want to hear from you. The numbers to reach us are 808-941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands. It's Friday, March 9th. We pick up the conversation right after the news.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us on today's show are Sonia Begalke-Bannon, Executive Director, National Association of Social Workers in Hawaii. She says there are 964 licensed clinical social workers in the state and 825 licensed social workers. But is that enough? Dana Kano is an administrator with Child Welfare Services. She's been there for more than 30 years. She began as a line worker and now oversees four service units with up to 75 staff members. Child Welfare Services helps to unify families as well as arranging legal guardianship or adoption of children. It also provides services for youth who have exited foster care through age 26. And Francie Julian Chin spent over 10 years working in the child welfare system and is currently assistant professor at the Myron B. Thompson School of Social Work at the University of Hawaii.
Well, and welcome to you all. And today we're talking with social workers about the misconceptions and hurdles faced on the job. And we want to ask you, the listener, what is the current state of the welfare of children in Hawaii? What are the mechanisms in place to protect them? How has this affected you? We do want to hear from you, the listener. The numbers to reach us on Oahu are 941-3689. That's the Oahu number. Outside Oahu, anywhere on the neighbor islands, 1-877-941-3689 on neighbor islands. And as we welcome our guests, we are kind of talking in the context of some criticisms of the system that have been offered and wanted to sort of set the record straight with people who are doing the actual work. So thanks for offering that perspective. What would you like the public to know that it doesn't, Dana?
Well, I can start, maybe.
Sure.
This is Francie, and I think it's important to know that from the article that this is really a national issue. That if you look at the Children's Bureau research and the Child Welfare Information Gateway, the information that they put out, they have on their website that this is a workforce crisis nationally that is being experienced, that there are ranges between 20 to 90% turnover, depending on the state or region that you're in. And so that this is not a unique issue to Hawaii. It's a national issue. And
sure.
There's a lot of research that's being conducted and has been conducted on how to improve retention, support the frontline worker, because we know that this is emotionally very difficult work. It's challenging for our caseworkers. And we know that our supervisors are key in providing support for our caseworkers. So research into how to help our supervisors support caseworkers and get our legislature to encourage, you know, the funding that is necessary.
Most of us who don't do this kind of work are very glad that there are people who are willing to, but what are some of the challenges that you folks face?
I think the challenges come with the demands of the job and working with just such a diverse population, and at sometimes we're intervening in people's lives where, you know, they don't see it as a problem, and so our staff goes in and has to address the multiple needs that families have to keep our children safe and keep our families together.
And Dana, you're speaking with your 30 years experience with the Child Welfare Service.
That's correct.
And what about you, Sonia? What can you share with us?
So social workers are a very unique breed of people. They're really hardworking people. They're very caring people. And they're willing to go into a field that is historically underpaid and often criticized. You know, you never hear about the good things that social workers do. You hear when there's a lack or a failing. So, you know, most of us are master's educated, if not more. You know, many are licensed. If you work for the state of Hawaii, you don't have to have your social work license. You just have to have your degree. But, you know, we kind of run in when everybody's running the other way. We're the people that head in to conflict, to, you know, to try to bring peace, to try to bring stability. And we do it on usually very meager salaries.
Are there enough of you?
No, definitely not. You know, I think that the Bureau of Labor and Statistics nationally said that there's a growth of 13% just in the last year in the need for social workers. And as we have a population that's aging, especially in Hawaii, there is more and more of a need. Gerontology is one of the newer fields in social work. And there, you know, so we've got lots of place for social workers in gerontology. There is a huge opening for social workers in child and family. The state can't fill jobs. There are jobs that are continuously open that we need to get social workers into. So we're continuing to train and produce really high quality social workers here in the state with the three schools that have programs. BYU Hawaii has a bachelor's program for social work, and then HPU and UH both have master's level as well as bachelor programs. And there's also a doctoral program at the University of Hawaii.
What's an ideal skill set to do this job?
I think that the social work education, being a former caseworker and now teaching students who are going out to do child welfare work, I really think that, you know, the bachelor's in social work, the master's in social work, gives the education, the skills, the knowledge and abilities to really prepare an individual to go out and do this very challenging work that is, like Dana mentioned, you know, the multiple decision makings, working with lack of resources at times, you know, having lots of paperwork to fill out, and then dealing with the emotional load that the work takes on you. I think that our social work department really prepares students in partnership with the department to go out and do the job when they graduate.
Well, that emotional load that Francie just referred to, Dana, you've been facing that for a 30-year career. What sustains you?
It's huge. I think that the rewards of the job and the satisfaction of seeing, you know, how the efforts of our job really, you know, it is there to help families. And I was just looking back at some of the numbers in terms of staffing, in terms of the workload and demands. And right now, statewide, we have about 135 professional social work positions, whether those be the human services professionals, those that don't have their master's degree. And we're running about a vacancy of just under 30. And again, those are just the professional staff. And as of the end of February, statewide, there were 1,574 kids in foster care. So that in and of itself, when you just think about even the ratio of one worker to a child, that's huge, and that's just one child.
So what's the caseload?
They vary. Some people have 40, some people have 12. It just kind of depends on where they are in each section and how they're able to manage their workload.
If we can just take a moment, I'd like to go around the room and just find out, you know, how did you get into social work? Was there a particular instance or an experience that you had? Because it really takes someone who cares an awful lot, I think, to be a social worker and to stay in for as long as you have.
I think like a lot of people, I got in with a desire to help people and know that I could make a difference. And I would say that even looking at the supervisors that I have now, they've been there at least 10 years, and they too have come through the rank and file and are able to mentor their staff and working towards making the system better.
Dana, what's an example of a way, you know, let's choose a hypothetical family and say, how do you make a difference in the life of a family, a client family?
I think it's from the very beginning. It's from our initial contact when the worker goes out and makes that introduction, and their ability to engage and work through some of the fear and the anger that some clients initially present with. We then do Ohana conferences where we're able to engage families and people that are important in their lives and try and help them be part of the planning, whether, you know, we're able to support reunification and get their engagement and really put in the services in place that they need. And from there, if we're looking at relative or other types of placements and permanency options for our youth, that everyone's on the same page from the very beginning. And I think that when we're able to do that, I think that the outcome is much more successful.
When you say fear and anger, is that anger at an intrusion into the family life?
Absolutely.
That's what it's seen as?
That's what it's usually seen as. They don't see themselves as having done anything wrong. They think that they are providing the best that they can for their children, and they just maybe sometimes they are. They just need a little bit more help.
Francie?
Sure. I think I had many similar motivations. I wanted to help people, and social work just seemed like a calling. I actually kind of stumbled into child welfare. It was a young bachelor's level student, and it seemed like a good job. And I found it so incredibly rewarding. I ended up getting my master's and then staying and becoming a supervisor and a manager. And what that showed me was all of the amazing work that happens that unfortunately doesn't get publicized. But, you know, really just making a difference in one child's life, one family's life at a time. And seeing the rewards of the case managers and how hard they worked and all the good things that happen every day and how many children are protected and families that are maintained together because of the determination of all of these caseworkers that just put really their hearts and souls into their work and care so much. And so it's our job then to support them so that we can make sure they stay and have a healthy work-life balance.
Sonia.
So I came into this career like actually a lot of social workers in my 30s. So this was a second career for me. I stumbled into social work from other helping professions. I had been in disaster relief, and I'd been an emergency medical technician, and then I had done safety and compliance for an Army program. And I kept finding this similar theme of wanting to reach out and help and facilitate and you know, look at system-wide change and look at problems from a big scale as opposed to, you know, an individual scale, but really look at, you know, what the bigger issues were. And that's what social work is all about. We talk about person and environment, and, you know, we look at a problem. We don't just isolate that problem to this is happening, you know, with this one individual in this household. We look at how this individual fits into the rest of their community, what their background is like. You know, each problem is a creation of many, many, many layers of issues. And so social work for me was really the right fit because that was the way I thought and the way I problem solved and broke things down. And that's what's really creative and unique about the social work profession is we really look at problems from a different perspective. We don't just kind of, even when we do, licensed clinical social workers do therapy, and we don't just look at kind of family history or we don't just look at, you know, what your childhood was like. We really look at how you fit into your current life, your current environment, you know, how that affects you as an individual.
Let's just briefly identify ourselves. You're listening to The Conversation. We are inviting listeners to call in, and let me just give those numbers. 941-3689 is the number from Oahu. On Neighbor Islands, the number is 1-877-941-3689. Sunday, the headline in the local newspaper was Child Welfare Services, No Signs of Improvement, and it referred to a series of studies done over the years in which the metrics for improvement were not met, and that led us to ask a panel, our in-studio panel, for their perspective. We also want the perspective of callers who have been affected at any degree by the child welfare services system. And Catherine, would you introduce our guests?
Yes, sir. Our guests again, Sonia Bigalki-Bannon, Executive Director of the National Association of Social Workers in Hawaii, Dana Kano, Administrator for Oahu Child Welfare Services, and Francie Julianne Chin, who has spent 10 years working in the child welfare system. We did get an email from one of our listeners, reluctant to call in, very thoughtful interesting notes that she submitted, and I'll just read a portion of it. She says, "It's very unfortunate that the way our media works now, that government agencies only make the news when something goes wrong, giving the public a very skewed picture of what the agency accomplishes. I have yet to see a headline that says, 'Social workers save 100 children from abusive homes this month,' and go on to detail the numerous things they did right." And that was sent in from Anne.
I gather you folks have some agreement with that. I would think so. And it's an unfortunate fact of journalism that one disaster tends to override 100 success stories. Has that been your impression? Francie?
Yes, definitely working in the field that, you know, anytime something happens that didn't go right, that makes the paper. But the successes that happen every day are not there. And that's what keeps, I think, us going, you know, those of us in the field. And it would be great to highlight those successes also.
One of the things that's also mentioned in that particular newspaper article is staff turnover. Have you folks seen a lot of that?
We've seen a lot. Our staffing numbers were down significantly. I think we're starting, at least on Oahu, to see some improvement in terms of the numbers coming in through our collaboration with the UH School of Social Work. And we're able to bring students in, and when they graduate, they work in the department, and they have a payback of a couple of years depending on which part of the program they're in. And so that's a way we gain our staff. They do a first-year practicum. They do their practicum with us, and so they gain hands-on experience. So as they enter the workforce after they graduate, they are prepared to take on a caseload and start working in the field. So that's been successful. Last year we had 9 graduates. This year we're expecting 5 more to graduate, and they will be part of our workforce in July.
The stories of staff turnover are undoubtedly kind of a disincentive. But when you're recruiting someone to work with you, how would you go about that?
Well, social work is a really broad field. So people go into social work wanting to do child and family or mental health or school social work or community organizing or clinical. So it's really about trying to find the right person for that field that fit. And it has to be a very special person, because people who go into child and family service on average make $10,000 less than social workers that go into medical social work or the mental health field. Mm-hmm. And that's something we need to work to fix. In our state hiring system, for example, the state social worker 3 and 4 jobs pay the same as the human service jobs, which are also the same category. And the social work jobs require a master's very specifically in social work or a bachelor's in social work, and the human services ones require just a bachelor's and then a smattering, a handful of courses in human services or psych or social work. So we need to start valuing the profession more, and we need to be able to really protect the profession. And when we ask people to go to work in difficult jobs like this, that we're paying them appropriately, that we're paying them as a master's level clinician. You know, it is hard work. That, you know, there's a lot of passion. There's a lot of, you know, feel good when your clients are having success. But there are a lot of challenges. And as we're still trying to get more people into these jobs, there are heavy caseloads. And so we need to make sure that we are supporting our social workers financially so that they're not needing a second job. I mean, you know, most social workers in the state are making somewhere around the $50,000 range, which doesn't get you a lot of square footage on Oahu, right?
Can we also talk about the inequity, since this is Women's Month, also about the fact that most of the social workers are women, and if they're not being paid adequately?
Absolutely. In our profession, we are starting to get more men into the field, which is fantastic, but 80% of social workers are women, and it's a field, much like teaching, that has been historically underpaid because it's a traditionally female profession. And even within our field, we're seeing that men who enter into social work are getting paid more than women, and women of color are getting paid even less. So we need to really address these inequities, and we need to ask for support from the legislature to fund these, you know, state programs that we can pay people at higher rates. And we need to really look at the state hiring system, look at DHERD, and look at the classifications for these jobs to make sure that social workers with really specific training and a master's degree are getting paid appropriately.
And the one thing I just wanted to add to that is that within child welfare is that we do have the CAPS specialist. So that is it is a pay range that's separate and apart from your social worker 3s, 4s, and 5s. So that is at least one recognition of the work that Child Welfare Services does that is a little bit more challenging.
Let's bring in the perspective of a caller on the line from Hilo. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I wanted to comment on this. You know, I wanted to say that this is such an important job, is to keep families safe and especially kids safe. But I think it's important to note that caseworker bias really needs to be kept in check because, you know, we're all human, we're all biased. Independent investigation actually needs to be conducted. And I know this is mostly due to a lack of resources, too, like we're talking about. I know a caseworker who typically has 40 children, and how can that be, you know, a quality job if we have so much quantity? That comes down to 1 hour a week, a working week, per child. There is a pilot bill right now to limit the caseloads to 20 children per caseworker. There's also a pilot program in East Hawaii, I forget the name of it, but it's where they have the intense investigation in the actual home before the kids are taken to try to do all that they can preventatively before the kids are actually taken. I think these two programs really need to be supported because I think it needs to be addressed, too, that the intense trauma that's created by removing children from homes and breaking up families needs to be prevented as much as possible. These people need help, not only the families, but the caseworkers and the government officials who are trying to do their best to keep everybody together.
Thanks for that call. Dana Cano of the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare Services. How does that sound to you, that limiting to 20? Is that workable, 20 children per caseworker?
There is a House and Senate bill right now that's in the legislature being heard for specifically for East Hawaii to pilot that, I believe, for the next 5 years in terms of limiting and capping the caseload, which is something that we've not been able to do within Child Welfare Services ever, although there are national standards in terms of caseload capping. We have a requirement. I mean, we need to fulfill our mandates, which is to keep children safe. So this is a good opportunity to see if we're able to caseload cap and limit the number of cases that a worker is assigned, how much more effective we can be. And also, I believe the caller was referring to our intensive home-based services, which came about as part of a waiver initiative, and that those waiver services are available on Oahu and both East and West Hawaii Island, on the Big Island, to really work with families and try and keep them in-home. It's an intensive in-home service that we've been able to contract.
That sounds very labor-intensive, Dana.
It is, but, you know, if you can get in up front and do the work and make the difference, then hopefully families are successful and we are no longer involved in their case.
Sonia, you see this on a national level, right, as part of a national organization, that 20 children per caseworker, does that sound workable to you?
Oh, it's kind of a dream amount. It's what is kind of best practice and what we would all love to see in the field. But it also means, again, more money for staffing so that we can make sure that those jobs are filled, and, you know, really prioritizing, filling those jobs. It also takes a while to get everybody trained and ready to go in terms of a caseload. So sometimes you start people out on a smaller caseload and kind of work them up. But I worked in case management myself, and we averaged, you know, over 40 as well. So it's really normal, unfortunately, to have, you know, about 40 clients for a caseload. And, you know, based on severity, sometimes you'll have fewer clients but that need more more time and attention. But unfortunately, across the country, this is a trend that's echoed. Caseloads are always too high because the funding isn't enough. So if we can, you know, put something in place, we've been tracking this bill too, this pilot program, and it would be wonderful. I mean, that would be it would be great worker protection in terms of being able to really focus on and put the time in for 20 clients to make, you know, to make a difference and to be able to do everything you want to do. Because as a social worker, there's always so much you want to do for your clients and help them to accomplish. And there are never enough hours in the day. And, I mean, to be honest, there's nobody who just works a 40-hour week in social work. Everyone goes above and beyond, and there's always, you know, you're trying to, you know, look at other programs and look at other resources and maximize as much as you can do for your clients. But you're always, you know, thinking at the end of the day when you're laying in bed trying to fall asleep, oh, you know, I really wish we could have gotten that bus pass today. You know, let's try to get that done next week. You're always trying to, you know, think about the next thing, the next need for your client. So that would be wonderful if we could limit that. But that also means making sure that those jobs are filled. So that means that clients are still getting services.
If I could take this point to read again from the email sent in by Ann, who's a social worker. She says it's a kind of a thankless job. There are always crises, so the paperwork, which is very detailed and specific, as it is a legal document, is hard to get to. And then there is a constant exposure to trauma. Seeing children mistreated, often very badly, injured or neglected, is not fun. And often the parents are not in such good shape either. And often there are really not good solutions. Resources are scarce. Again, underscoring the need for some help because you're carrying a very heavy caseload.
There's a caller with a related question. Can you hear me? Caller from Honolulu?
Yes.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, the question I have is, what is the Child Welfare Service Division doing to retain their employees for longevity?
Well, we were talking about that earlier with our panel, and you folks were telling us that there are a great many people who stay with it, and you've been in it for 30 years, right?
I think our staff is certainly dedicated. They're committed to the work. They see the passion. They see how rewarding it can be. Unfortunately, it's the challenging cases, as we said, that hit the press that just kind of make you always second guess. I think this is one of those jobs. It's 24/7. As you said, they lie awake at night or they end their day thinking what else could have been done and what's on their plate for tomorrow. And, you know, did they do the right thing? And just always, I think they're always second guessing themselves. The people that stay certainly have that they're dedicated and they really do believe they make a difference. And I think that really supports the retention. And for even those that have come to child welfare and have left, the experience that they have gained for however long or short the time is, I think it makes them just different and better people, whatever profession or whatever course of social work they enter into, just knowing what it's like to be a child welfare services worker.
Do some people come into the job with unrealistic expectations?
Oh, absolutely. I think because we're the kind of people that want to save the world, you know, everyone comes in with, I'm going to fix absolutely everything for everybody and, you know, try their darndest. But we talk about in social work readiness to change and the stages of change, and we need to meet our clients where they are. And not everybody is ready for change at the time that they're, you know, seeing us for services. So we really work with the client to set what their goals and their expectations are as opposed to trying to impose our goals and our expectations. And sometimes you really want to get a client into maybe substance abuse treatment or something like that, and they're just not ready. And you know that would be the best thing for them, but it's not they're not at that place yet. So I think learning to be client focused and client centered and really understand where our clients are is one of the hardest things to learn when you first enter the field at a school, because you think you're just going to fix everything, and you're gonna tie off all those loose ends, but it doesn't quite work that way.
We know at the Department of Education, when it's hard to place teachers in maybe rural areas, there may be incentives to draw people to that area. Is there anything like that for social work on the neighbor islands or rural areas?
At least in the past, there was a shortage differential for some of the outlying rural areas, and right now there is nothing in place.
What happened to that differential?
Just went away. So again, they do have the Child and Adult Protective Services Specialist Series, which is the one that sets the Child and Adult Welfare Protective Services workers apart from the DOH social workers or DOE social workers. That series is not available.
Okay. We talked about cases that do make the headlines, and both Chris and I, when we worked in television news, we certainly covered the Peter Boy Kema case, which has been resolved. There was an issue, I think, where the state had to pay out some money for Zion McEwen on Maui in 2012, where CPS took the child, returned him to his mother, and then he was sent to his father, who was facing murder charges in that case. And there was, I think, another case in 2005 of Alexis, 10-year-old Alexis, on the Big Island, living in what was called a house of horrors. She had permanent damage from malnutrition and just was really mistreated. So they're really just very sad cases and horrific cases that we see in the news. And You know, just makes me wonder why we don't have the differential if there are places that are in desperate need of social workers to avoid these kinds of cases making the headlines.
I don't know that it's always about the money in terms of the pay and the salaries that come with the job. I think it's a job you have to want to do. I don't know how you can put a dollar on amount on the kind of work we do and what it takes just internally. And, you know, we talk about secondary trauma and just what our staff deals with on a regular basis. And while money sounds like sometimes it is, you know, the ultimate goal, it may not make a difference.
Secondary trauma being a term for the effect on the social worker?
Absolutely.
I never heard that particular term used, but obviously it's got to be very real. Mm-hmm. In the litany of problems that the families you deal with face, is substance abuse at the top?
It's a very big problem in our state and across the country. You know, meth continues to be an issue, and then the opioid epidemic has now really arrived here. We were late to the game compared to the rest of the mainland, but that's really here now and is becoming more and more systemic. So that's something that we are dealing with in as well as other issues. But it's really common in our field to be working with families or individuals with substance abuse issues.
I was just going to say, I agree. The state I came from, over 80% of the families involved in the child welfare system were due to substance abuse. So, yes.
Yes.
What's number two if substance abuse is number one? What are some of the other sort of categories of problems that affect your families, the families that you deal with?
We do see a lot of domestic violence mm-hmm. within our families. I mean, it could be as a result of substance abuse.
Of course, there are
so
related.
Many other issues that,
sure.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. How prevalent is domestic violence among your client families?
I think that it's a really hard thing to measure because there's different ways that we find out about domestic violence. Sometimes a child might tell a teacher. Sometimes police might be called into the home. But often it's hidden, and we don't find out about it until something else happens. Maybe the child's been abused or neglected, and then we build trust with the family, and the mother might come out and say, oh, you know, I've also been being physically abused or emotionally abused. So I think it's sometimes a really difficult aspect of a case to measure. I don't know if you agree.
I agree. It's usually as a result of something else that, you know, mom and dad are fighting, mm-hmm. and that's how we find out about the intimate partner violence that's happening.
It's probably almost impossible to categorize problems in terms of separating one from the other because they're all kind of intertwined. Let me just interrupt our discussion very briefly to say that we want our listeners to join us in this discussion of child welfare and the way the state and government deals with it. We want to hear from you, and the numbers you can reach us by are 808-941-3689 on Oahu, 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands, and there's a caller on the line from Hilo. Jonathan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Talk to me.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to thank you guys for this opportunity to throw out this discussion, and my wife and I are resource caregivers. We've been on the Big Island for over 20 years, working with families, you know, on top of being foster parents. We also work with an agency that helps to support, you know, resource caregivers as well. And myself, I'm a trainer. And as I was thinking about this, the earlier caller did mention the bill that is trying to go through on the House bill and Senate bill. I believe the numbers for these versions are HB 2277 and SB 2276. For those of you listening, I want to support. We're really trying to make a movement to help support this, so the community, resource caregivers, and just, you know, citizens out there to go ahead and look it up on the website and try to support the bill. Even place a testimony. I believe it'll help the wonderful social workers that need help as one of the assistants. And it's something, if we do get that cap in Hilo to have 20 children per caseworker, the quality of work, as mentioned, will be significant. As my wife and I have been doing this for over 20 years, we've had some great success with many youth that, as was mentioned, hardly is told. But we do hear of the cases that are, you know, horrible and horrific, and we wonder how could this happen. But more or less, I think if there are caps, it will be able to help keep these great social workers in place and inspire others to come to the field, because many of these workers come out wanting to help families and children, but I believe they get burnt out or stressed out. And if they get the proper support, they'll be able to continue to work and really help out these families and children. So I really believe, you know, to have great resources as well as support, and it'll probably expose, you know, a different need within the department. But I believe it has to start somewhere so we can get quality work from these people who go into this field from the beginning. And maybe it is a regular thing to have like 30, 40 kids per case, but if we can follow that national standard that brings up quality work, I believe that's where money should be invested for our future generations.
Jonathan, you said you and your wife are foster parents. What motivated you to become foster parents?
Well, I think, as with earlier callers, people are talking about the desire to help others. And my wife and I, you know, we come from some pretty challenging beginnings, and we were able to get out of it, thank God. And I think really being able to help out children, pay it forward in a sense. And with my family, my mom actually was raised in foster care, and I've heard, you know, some of the things that she's been through. And I think if we have quality workers able to help out, you know, back in the 40s and 50s when my mom was in care, there are people who want to help out families that are in need, especially the children. And it's so important that it is there, the help is there. So friends of ours from our church had recommended us to become foster parents. And since the day we started it off, we haven't turned our backs.
Jonathan, thanks very much for calling in to us. And that was, does that reflect what you've seen, you folks have seen in our studio, have seen about people who've become foster parents, that kind of motivation?
Yeah, I just listened to Jonathan. It just kind of warms my heart. It's kind of a chicken skin moment, yeah. And it's just kind of an affirmation.
I know we hear that phrase, pay it forward, and very often when you do see, when you take a child into your home and you see their successes and the pride to know that you've helped someone maybe through a time of dysfunction and finally getting their feet on the ground, it's very rewarding. So while maybe sometimes we talked about the pay, you know, for these jobs in social work or for foster families, because that pay has also been an issue too, because sometimes these families give so much love, but it does take a lot of resources to help raise a child.
Let's hear from Malachi in Honolulu. Malachi, you had some thoughts about case management.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I was a community-based nurse case manager during the AIDS pandemic. And luckily, we were grant-funded, so we had some extra money to care for staff because our burnout level was very high. Two things that helped. One was to have an assessment model, which I've heard you guys refer to, of client-centered, family-centered harm reduction model. So that means, you know, you make a list of the problems. What are the most harmful ones? Let's focus on that. And what are their strengths? You know, the strengths may not appear to be one until you really look deeply, you know. Mom comes home and makes dinner every day, even though dad may be drunk, you know, whatever it is. So things like that. The other thing was collaboration was key. And that doesn't always work depending on the time you have and the community you're working in. But I found, since my clients were so needy, I really needed to have good relationships. I would try to attend the hospice meetings, the school meetings, the substance abuse treatment centers meetings. Sometimes I'd bring coffee or chocolate just to grease the wheels so that I might have a better chance of, you know, getting services out there in the community. But we did burn out. And since we're grant funded, they give us a day every 3 months. months or so to go out as a team and do something to enjoy each other, to de-stress and things like that. So it's an incredibly difficult job you guys go, and I salute you because children are so vulnerable, you know, and what are their strengths? You know, resilience, survival, but a lot of ways they're left on their own, and you know, you're the same good person in their life, so I salute you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael Kai, for your call. There's a caller online from Mountain View that speaks kind of directly to what Malachi was just saying. Sharon, can you hear me?
Hi, yes, I can. I don't know what Malachi was saying because I tried to get out of shot of the radio. So
He was talking about burnout in the job, which I figured that you could address.
Oh, yes. I actually just quit at the end of January rather abruptly as a point of like keeping going. And then I had some personal things come up that just were the catalyst, and I just couldn't do it anymore and couldn't do my job and stay emotionally and physically healthy. And I felt that I was more of a detriment being there than it would have been to just quit and heal. So I have some real thoughts on it all. Number one, I really support the bill 100%. I'm not able to do the social work that I would like to do with the individual families because your most important skill would be time management, just basically able to put out fires and put on Band-Aids and move on. So I think that a lesser caseload, a more manageable caseload would be amazing. The criticism that you get for not staying on top of everything, you get to just, you don't even hear it after a while because you get it from everywhere constantly and become sure after a while that you're just not a good worker. You have to constantly do self-talk saying, I'm doing my best, I'm doing a good job, I'm doing what I can do. And after a while, that's very damaging as well. And I think that the people that have stayed for like 17 years are numb to a lot of it and get very policy driven. And I think that more supervisors and units in place are great as well. One supervisor handling all of these workers with all of their cases, how can they stay in except to get numb? And I just find that, you know, it's just a burden for everyone in the system. But I think that if you had more time as a social worker and more time as a supervisor to actually look at the problems that exist and address them and really give support in the ranks, because there's not enough support of workers inside the ranks because everyone's just trying to make the deadline. Then sitting in court and having, you know, being a day or so late or a week late with your report and getting the whole agency gets charged $500 because you're late and the judge is angry. And, you know, you can only go through that a certain amount of times and it wears on you. So I've done a lot of social work jobs. I've had my master's degree since 2014. I'm a mature student. I got my bachelor's social work job in 1998 and after my kids left home. And I have a lot of life experience and all those years working with the most difficult children in adolescent psych, in schools, and in group homes, and from Canada. And I have never had a job that had, and I consider myself to be a very strong person, but I've never had a job like this that's just so demanding. So I just wanted to say that, you know, with a little more time, our social workers could address the real needs individually and not just be trying to catch up and work their 80 hours a week.
Thanks very much for your call, Sharon.
We have another listener that emailed us. She says, my name is Jenny. I'm listening to the panel conversation. I heard a question about staff retention, and the question was about what the department is doing to address this. And she says, I don't think the question was really answered. Can I please ask the same question? What is being done to retain the experienced staff the department has?
I think that just speaking on a kind of a national level, the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute puts out summaries frequently about strategies to retain, what factors influence turnover, which many the caller, that last caller just spoke to. But there are many efforts that are going on. You know, obviously, financially is not within the department's control at all times, but supervisory support is one key piece to help with that emotional trauma or the secondary vicarious trauma that we talk about, so that we can lessen some of that burnout. But there is the paperwork that can be overwhelming. There's also a lot of talk of that watching a realistic job preview video before accepting the job. So starting with hiring, looking at hiring for fit. So looking for individuals who have a realistic understanding of the work that they're going into, are more likely to stay long term, providing morale and, you know, retention incentives, which I'm sure all of your units do, you know, to try to support their caseworkers. You know, we did different things of, you know, between little parties to tokens to, you know, anything that we could do to support our caseworkers and help them feel that they are needed and wanted and doing a great job, whatever was it within our control. But I'm sure Dana can expand.
Well, there is no, I mean, as far as what we can do is by at least being able to recruit staff and increase our workforce, then the caseloads will go down and there's more bodies to distribute the workload to, and therefore people, you know, feel better about doing the job, and hopefully that also will add towards retention.
There's also evidence that the workers who go through a collaboration like the school, the university, and the department have, either a 4E or our Hawaii Child Welfare Education collaboration, are more likely to stay in their position. So having this partnership between the university and the department is one really strong way to retain child welfare workers.
That's what I was going to say as well. I think that the model of the HECWIC program that has been developed between UH and the department is fantastic, because you really put social workers in when they're in training, during their practicum, in place, so they have a very realistic understanding of what they're getting into. So I think you're training the next generation of really stellar case managers and social workers who are going to stay, because they've, from the beginning, they've got realistic expectations about what they're getting into and what the workload's like. And by the time you get up to a full caseload, you've had that entire year as a practicum student, and, you know, you've gotten to kind of ease in there. And I think that's, you know, the best way to provide that kind of training. So yeah.
We've had a couple of caseworkers, just during that last couple of minutes, we've had a couple of caseworkers call in. Here's a caller from Honolulu who is a caseworker. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, tell me your story.
So I've been, I'm currently a social worker. I've been with the department for about a year and a half now. And, you know, I've been listening in for a little while now, and I've heard that there have been multiple testimonies from other caseworkers and resource caregivers. My hope is that the public realize that, you know, in light of everything that they're reading in the newspapers and in, you know, everything they see on social media and in main broadcasting, the problems are very real, but the social workers really are trying their best. And unfortunately, it's not a matter of are we working hard enough. I think it's much more so a systemic issue. And you could ask, you know, mostly anyone in the department, and then they would tell you the same thing. Staffing is a major issue. Retention is a humongous issue. But we're working at our candle's end, essentially. And burnout is a very real reality. I mean, you talk to any social worker now, and, you know, if they've been in child welfare for the past year, majority have had multiple thoughts of quitting, or they have exit strategies already planned out, myself included.
Thank you for calling and sharing that. We have another call from the Big Island, Randy, who is a case social worker from Kau. What's on your mind?
I've been 15 years in Kau as a mental health case manager, and I agree with everything that's been said, and I have a little bit stronger emotions, I think, because I'm mid burnout probably, and that is that unless the state values their children and values, you know, half the people on the street by statistics have mental illness, unless we value and we fund these services, they're not going to exist. And right now, the Kau District, we're not third world yet, but we're second world. I mean, we have two police officers for the whole Kau District. They're bigger than Oahu. And I have been in many Ohana meetings and many, many really, I love the child welfare model. It sure would be nice to have enough people to put it in place. Just like what I do for a living, 40 clients, it's absurd. You know, you're not really going to be able to, your best practices, it's just, and it really does get down to the legislature and valuing people, okay? And anyway, hang in there, guys. The last thing I'll say is in my agency alone, I think, without exaggerating, about 80% of the people that are hired in, bright, young, well-educated people with good intent and good hearts, burn and are gone within 8 months to 12 months. There just simply is not enough money in the field to not add the stress of how am I going to pay rent and how I'm going to make my car payment. A good example of that is not paying mileage in an area that's, you know, 245 miles around the Big Island, and many agencies don't pay mileage. It's time for things to change, and put, you know, the legislators have to put their money where the mouth is, I guess. Anyway, hang in there, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy, for calling in. We've only got a minute or so left, but I wanted to get some final thoughts from our panel. It seems as if more funding is top of mind and runs throughout all these comments we've been hearing.
Absolutely. You know, be it a state agency or a nonprofit that's doing the work, money is definitely tight in the social services field. And as regards to, you know, finding support, we'll put our plug in to join NASW, join the National Association of Social Workers. We do a lot of events for self-care and training, and we're here to help you. So think about becoming a member, and we'll do our best to keep you engaged and keep you in the field.
We'd like to thank all our guests for taking part today. We've run to the end of our time. Francie Julie Chen is an assistant professor at UH Manoa. Sonia Bigalke Bannon is executive director of the National Association of Social Workers Hawaii. Dana Kano, an administrator with Oahu Child Welfare Services. Thank you all for joining us on The Conversation.
And we thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. I'm Catherine Cruz.
I'm Chris Vanderkoek.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.